back in the cold depths of this past January, which seems quite a ways away given the way weather we had yesterday, but back in those days, I took a weekend sabbatical trip in the Hyde Park section of Chicago where I was living, to travel a couple hundred miles even further north, where it was even colder than in Chicago, the town of Stevens Point, Wisconsin. I had some friends up there who were on the faculty at the University of the Wisconsin campus in that town that I wanted to look in on and catch up on some old times with. It was something of a nostalgic trip since it was 30 years ago this summer that I moved from southern Indiana to Stevens Point to be the campus minister there on behalf of several mainline Protestant denominations. That settlement proved to be my last one before jumping ship to the Unitarian Universalist, but that's another story which many of you have already heard. So driving around this rather small central Wisconsin town last January did take me back there to when I first arrived in that place in the late summer of 1974. As I recall, it was right after Richard Nixon had resigned the presidency. And it was at that time that I experienced the most profound 2 or 3 weeks worth of loneliness that I think I have ever known. It had nothing to do with Nixon's resignation. I just threw that in. I was single. I did not know a soul in that town other than the people who were on the campus ministry board who had offered me the position, and they were all off doing their own end of summer things. The fall semester was still a few weeks away, and I was high and dry and estranged. I spent a lot of my evenings reading John O'Hara novels, no less. I had to do something. And when that got old, I would go out around town to stores, mostly little stores, mom-and-pop grocery stores and stationery stores and bookstores and the like, and I would purchase things that I didn't even need just so I could chat with the clerks for a while. I knew I needed some kind of human contact, even if it was just a conversation across a store counter, and so I went out looking for it. Well, those few weeks went by. The academic year kicked in. I got some programs up and running and started getting to know people in this town, and that brief period of loneliness and estrangement quickly faded into the background. In fact, as my ministry went on there, my apartment, which was just a few blocks off campus, became something of a crash pad for students or campus hanger-oners who needed a place to stay for a night. You know, not getting along with my roommate, there was too much noise in the apartment. Well, I would grab our sleeping bikes over and sleep on Steve's floor, and they would come and do that. To the point that sometimes I actually miss those earlier and lonelier days. I've been in town by myself. But I can't help but be aware of how the memory of those first few weeks in a strange town, particularly as they came back to me several weeks ago, have left such a lasting impression on me. I think it's because of that that I continue to have feelings of empathy for those who find themselves in similar type of situations. And I think another reason why I remember those few weeks so well is because they really go against my more usual or normal grain. I generally enjoy solitude and aloneness. And I had that brought home to me by another incident from about this same period of my life, which with your forbearance, I will also relate. I got into one of these personal growth, self-discovery groups that were kind of your basic standard fare back in the mid-70s, human potential movement, all that kind of thing. This one was held where else? In Berkeley, California. And we did one of these pair up and introduce yourself exercise to someone that you never met or don't know before. And I've always played pretty straight in these situations, but it also occurs to me in these things that here would be a chance to completely reinvent yourself, and who's gonna know? But I played it straight. And in this case, my partner was a woman named Joyce, who in this larger group we'd been convened in beforehand had claimed that she had psychic powers. I tend to be rather something of a hard-headed skeptic about such things, but I decided not to challenge her on that, and we sat down to talk. And before I could even get a word out, she looks at me and says, "Did you spend a lot of time by yourself as a child when you grew up?" Well, yeah, actually, I did. Many of you have already heard me tell some of the stories about those summers I spent on my grandfather's Southern Ohio farm until I was about 14. There were no kids around my age. It was just my grandfather, my aunt, and two uncles. And I could play in the woods and tend to a small garden I was given to maintain and read a lot and generally enjoy myself. And those were my summers up until my early adolescence. Well, I knew that. You know that. But Joyce didn't. And I figured if she was going to attempt some psychic number on me, I wasn't going to give her any kind of freebie. So I just said, I was often by myself a lot during my growing up days, which is one of those things a lot of people can say to me. But she goes on. She says, when we were sitting in the large group there earlier, I saw you as a youngster sitting on top of a hill, looking out across a river at a valley and some mountains. Okay. Who is this woman and who's been slipping her the dope on me? Is this an episode of Candid Camera or the Twilight Zone here, as you see? My favorite personal spot on that farm was on top of a hill where I would sit for long periods of time by myself, looking out across this wide expanse of river bottom in the Ohio River and then some hills up behind that. And I was quite content to sit there for quite a long period of time and let whatever boyhood thoughts would go through my mind play themselves out. I was very much alone, but rarely, if ever, did I feel lonely. And how Joyce was able to see me there, so to speak, I don't know. I don't attempt to explain. Maybe she did have psychic powers. Or maybe she said things like that to everybody she met for the first time, figuring she had to hit it right once in a while. No, broken clock is still correct twice every 24 hours. I said I was a skeptic, remember? Well, either way, Joyce was a rather sweet lady, so I should give her the benefit of the doubt. Anyway, that little episode did serve to remind me that a significant part of my early life did involve learning how to be alone and actually liking it. Well, personal as they are, I offer these two episodes as a pairing of opposites when it comes to reflecting on loneliness. For they offer two images that I'm sure go well beyond just me. A young man in a strange town looking for some human contact, and a kid quite happy to be with himself and his own thoughts and mental meanderings. Each image speaks to certain realities of our human existence and of our journeys of the spirit. They each serve as well as illustrations of the many dualities that are inherent to our human nature and existence. And which John Selby points out in that passage I read earlier, it is one of the most curious paradoxes of human life that we are at the same time 100% social animals and also completely social beings. John Selby is a former mainline Protestant minister turned psychotherapist. And this little book of his, which is called Solitude, the Art of Living with Yourself, is actually a pretty good blend of spirituality and psychotherapy. And it can be read in about an hour and a half, so you might want to give it a whirl sometime. Well, the two realities I mentioned. Reality number one is that loneliness happens for a variety of reasons. Even the most self-sufficient of us will have times or be placed in circumstances where we will not receive the level of human contact and connectedness we need in order to feel human. We don't all need the same degree of this connectedness, but it is still, I feel, a universal human need. Finding even store clerks to talk to was my way of fulfilling that need for one very brief period in my life. And I'm guessing many of you have corresponding stories that you can relate that reflect your encounter with this piece of reality. Reality number two is equally true. We are each unique, alone selves. And that uniqueness, that aloneness, is something I feel to be affirmed and valued and even celebrated. That child by himself on the top of the hill, even though he did not have a language to express it in such terms, was reaching for that uniqueness and for that capacity for healthy aloneness. At some level of my being, I guess, I was playing out John Selby's observation years before he even wrote the words, human beings require periods of solitude to mature. It is extremely important that we develop a relationship with the solitary dimension of our lives, that we come to grips with the challenge of living alone, with our own internal selves, and that we become our best friend in life. Well, alongside of Selvig's observations, I'd like to bring in another one by Dr. Wayne Dyer, in a book he published right about the same time as my encounter group experience there. It's called Pulling Your Own Strings. Well, I must acknowledge on the outset that I'm not a big fan of Dyer's. I find much of his pop psychology material to be rather shallow and too self-directed and too self-centered for my liking. But in the matter of the aforementioned busted clock, it still tells the correct time twice a day. Dyer does get it right now and then. And if you like it better than I do, that's okay too. All right. Like here, where he says, in addition to realizing that you are unique to this world, you must also accept that you are always alone. Yes, alone. No one can ever feel exactly what you are feeling, whether you're surrounded by hundreds of thousands of people, or in an intimate relationship with one person, or by yourself in a closet. Your inevitable existential aloneness simply means that your human existence is unavoidably predicated on your being alone with your inner thoughts and feelings. Your recognition of this can be either very free or highly enslaving, depending on what you choose to do with it. But in either case, you will never change it. Dyer is not offering a rationale here for being a hermit or an antisocial person. He is writing about the stance from which you reach out beyond yourselves, like the kind of contacts we each in fact need for the sake of our human wholeness. I would say a person who has not recognized, and to some extent anyway, come to terms with his or her own existential aloneness, is going to be reaching out from a very needy kind of place that may well cause others to be wary of that individual. Of course, as I've been saying also, we need other people. Another pairing of opposites when it comes to Dyer's observation would be Kurt Vonnegut's statement that one human being is no human being. Dyer and Vonnegut are both speaking the truth. We recognize our humanity in relationship with other human beings. That's what Selvig was saying earlier. But Dyer's point is that no one person or group of persons can be for you what you can only be for yourself. And no one can entirely know and affirm you the way you have to do for yourself. The hope will be to expect it to be otherwise is to set yourself up for a kind of loneliness that will never be fully overcome. Well, if I go back to one of those two images I offered at the beginning of these thoughts, I believe I can offer an expanded illustration of the balance or pairing of these opposites that I'm trying to portray. When I look at my childhood self, up there on top of that hill, basking under an Ohio sun, in my delightful existential aloneness, a term that would have meant absolutely nothing to me at the time, I'm also aware that there was a house a little further down the hill where I felt safe and loved, and where I was shamelessly spoiled. But that's also another story. I'm further aware that had that house not been there, and had the people in it not been there, then the top of that hill would have been a very scary, a very frightening place for me to have been all by myself. Hardly a place at all where I could feel uniquely alone. Just another illustration of many of life's paradoxes, I think. In the early stages of life, one's uniqueness is best pursued and realized in the benign shadow of others. And this is why I think one of the greatest gifts we can give our children, be they our own children or the children whose lives are entrusted to us in any kind of way, one of the greatest gifts we can give our children is enough distance for them to discover their uniqueness and enough closeness so they feel safe in pursuing it. Well, to offer one more play on this dynamic of aloneness and loneliness, however much this existential aloneness is to be valued, it will not get rid of loneliness, nor should we expect it to. life happens. Sometimes life happens in some very joyful ways. Sometimes life happens in some very painful ways. It was a divorce and the loss of a job that had preceded my move to that central Wisconsin town in the first place. I know that's another reason why I still recall so well. My being high and dry had to do with more than just geography. And I probably would have been a little concerned about myself if I hadn't felt pretty lonely under those circumstances. It was also, in this instance, a signal to me that I was ready to re-engage with new people in a new setting and move my life into another place. It was reflective of something Dr. Carol Rubenstein, in her book, Search with In Search of Intimacy, says when she notes, loneliness is not an illness. It is more like a hunger. Just as hunger signals the body's need for nourishment, loneliness lets us know that certain important needs are going unmet. Loneliness can be a healthy hunger for intimacy and community. When my father passed away, the loneliness my mother felt for some time was not only to be expected, but in a real sense, it was a tribute to the years they had spent together. In a case like hers and others like it, such loneliness was not something to be quickly set aside or denied or even downplayed. But rather, it was something to be acknowledged as a positive statement about what a shared life had been all about, what it meant, and why it's still right here. The loneliness that comes after any kind of separation or ending or loss or major life change is certainly painful. But sometimes that is a pain that has to be, at least for a time, sat with and acknowledged, because it points to the positive value of what had been lost and is no more. This is yet another of the uses of loneliness. To begin to move to a close, I want to return to another portion of what I read earlier from John Selwyn. The spiritual metaphors of ancient sages and the contemporary descriptions of the interconnectedness of the new quantum physics both teach that there is no actual separateness possible in the universe. To say that all is one is a scientific as well as a spiritual statement. In certain dimensions of consciousness, you are clearly a separate individual, all alone in life. At the same time, you're an integral part of a whole of life on this planet. Last Sunday, as those of you who were here will recall, I took my, was going to be what started out to begin with as a Mother's Day message in another, in a direction other than my originally intended one, to speak of the latest of the increasingly troubling and devastating incidents growing out of our military presence in Iraq. As has already been mentioned, about half of that sermon showed up in the Telegraph, so I'm going to reiterate it anyway. Now you can go and read it yourself. But maybe it works to have these reflections for today follow on what I had to say last week in this one respect. One of the uses of loneliness or aloneness that I have found is that when certain of the workings of a larger world become too troubling or too overwhelming or too devastating, then I do need the time and I need the space to reconnect with this truth that Selby identifies, and that our own Unitarian Universalist, as well as just general humanitarian principles, affirm that there is no separateness possible in the universe, and that we are an integral part of the whole of life on this planet. First, there were and are the pictures of torture and abuse from inside that prison. And then there was the brutal and horrific execution of one of our American civilians who happened to be terribly in the wrong place at the wrong time and in the most cruel of wrong hands in Iraq. These are but the latest additions to what I'm seeing as an increasing madness. I'm not suggesting or offering solitude as an escape from or as a denial of some of the world's harshest and meanest realities, the likes of which we are seeing on almost a daily basis now. I am saying, quite strongly, But unless we each in our own way grant ourselves the personal space and the spiritual space to remind ourselves, in whatever ways we do that reminding, that there still is a blessed and sacred wholeness to this fragile and deeply wounded planet of ours. And we each still have a role to play as an integral part of that whole. To not find ways of reminding ourselves of this is to become vulnerable to being consumed by the same madness that is now consuming part of our world. We need one another. From out of that, we need aloneness and individuality that we each do possess. We need the human touch that reminds us in turn of our connectedness to the larger human family and to the web of life itself. We need that touch as a reminder that the well-being of our human community is still worth standing for, now more than ever. Let's sing that together. The hymn is